Chapter 3. Just at the time, all Petersburg was excited by a great piece of news. The rumor went about that the famous S had arrived in the town. The whole musical world of Petersburg was astir. Singers, actors, poets, artists, musical people, and even those who were not at all musical, but with modest pride declared that they did not know one note from another, rushed with eager enthusiasm to buy tickets. The hall could not seat a tenth of the enthusiasts who were able to pay 25 rubles for a ticket, but the European fame of S, his old age crowned with laurels, the unflagging freshness of his talent, the rumours that of late years he rarely took up the bow for the benefit of the public, the assertion that he was making the tour of Europe for the last time and would give up playing altogether afterwards, all produced an effect. In fact, the sensation was immense. I have mentioned already that the arrival of any new violinist, of a celebrity of any note, had a most unpleasant effect on my stepfather. He was always one of the first to hasten to hear of the new arrival, so as to discover quickly the full extent of his merits. He was often made really ill by the applause bestowed upon the newcomer, and was only pacified when he could discover defects in the new violinist's playing, and greedily circulated his opinion wherever he could. The poor madman recognized in the whole world but one musical genius, and that genius was, of course, himself. But the talk about the arrival of S, the musical genius, had a shattering effect upon him. I must observe that for the previous 10 years Petersburg had not heard a single famous musician, even of less distinction. Consequently, my father could have no conception of the play of European musicians of the first rank. I have been told that at the first rumours of S's visit, my father was seen again behind the scenes of the theatre. He is said to have seemed extremely agitated, and to have inquired uneasily of S and the approaching concert. It was a long time since he had been seen behind the scenes, and his appearance there made quite a sensation. Someone wanted to tease him, and with a challenging air said, "Now, Yegor Petrovich, old man, you are going to hear something very different from ballet music. Something that will make your life not worth living, I expect." I am told that he turned pale when he heard that jeer, but answered with an hysterical smile, "We shall see. Far-off bells always ring sweet. S, you know, has only been in Paris, and the French have made a fuss of him. And we know what the French are." And so on. There was a sound of laughter around him. The poor fellow was offended, but, controlling himself, added that he would say nothing. However, that we should see, that we should know, that the day after tomorrow was not long to wait, and that all doubts would soon be solved. B tells that just before dusk the same evening he met Prince X, a well-known musical amateur, a man with a deep love and understanding of music. They walked along together, talking of the newly arrived star, when all at once, at a street turning, B caught sight of my father, who was standing before a shop window, looking intently at a placard in it with an announcement in big letters of S's concert.
"Do you see that man?" said B, pointing to my father.
"Who is he?"
asked Prince X.
"You have heard of him already. That's Yefimov, of whom I have talked to you more than once, and on whose behalf you interested yourself on one occasion."
"Ah, that's interesting," said Prince X.
"You talked a great deal about him. I am told he is very interesting. I should like to hear him."
"That's not worthwhile,"
answered B.
"And it's painful. I don't know how it would be with you, but he always rends my heart. His life is a terrible, hideous tragedy. I feel for him deeply, and however abject he may be, my sympathy for him is not extinct. You say, Prince, that he must be interesting. That is true, but he makes too painful an impression. To begin with, he is mad, and then 3 crimes lie at his door, for besides his own, he has ruined 2 existences, his wife's and his daughter's. I know him. It would kill him on the spot if he realized his crime. But the whole horror of it is that for the last 8 years he has almost realized it, and for 8 years he has been struggling with his conscience on the brink of recognizing it. Not almost, but fully.
You say he is poor,
said Prince X.
Yes, but poverty is almost good fortune for him now, because it is an excuse. He can assure everyone now that poverty is the only thing that hinders him, and that if he were rich, he would have leisure and no anxiety, and it would be seen at once how far he was a musician. He married with the strange hope that the 1,000 rubles his wife had could help to give him standing. He behaved like a dreamer, like a poet, but he has always behaved like that all his life. Do you know what he has been continually saying for the last 8 years? He asserts that his wife is responsible for his poverty, that she hinders him. He has folded his hands and won't work. But if you were to take his wife away, he would be the most miserable creature on earth. Here he hasn't touched his violin for several years. Do you know why? Because every time he takes the bow in his hand, he is inwardly forced to admit that he is no good, a non-entity, not a musician. Now, while his fiddle is laid aside, he has a faint, remote hope that that is false. He is a dreamer. He thinks that all at once, by some miracle, he will become the most celebrated man in the world. His motto is Aut Caesar, Aut Nihil. As though one could become Caesar all at once, in 1 minute. He thirsts for fame, and if such a feeling becomes the mainspring of an artist's activity, then he ceases to be an artist, for he has lost the chief instinct of the artist, that is, the love for art, simply because it is art, and nothing else. Not fame. With S, on the other hand, it is quite the contrary. When he takes up his bow, nothing in the world exists for him but music. Next to his violin, money is the chief thing for him, and fame only comes third, I think. But he hasn't worried himself much about that. Do you know what is absorbing that luckless fellow now? Added B, pointing to Yefimov. He is engrossed by the most stupid, most trivial, most pitiful, and most absurd anxiety in the world. That is, whether he is superior to S or S is superior to him. Nothing less, for he is still persuaded that he is the foremost musician in the world. Convince him that he is not a musical genius, and I assure you, he would die on the spot, as though struck down by a thunderbolt. For it is terrible to part with a fixed idea to which one has sacrificed one's whole life, and which anyway rests on a deep and real foundation, for he had a genuine vocation at first.
But it will be interesting to see what happens to him when he hears S,
observed Prince X.
Yes, said B thoughtfully.
But no. He would recover at once. His madness is stronger than the truth, and he would at once invent some evasion.
You think so?
Said Prince X.
At that moment they came up to my father. He was trying to pass them unnoticed, but B stopped him and began speaking to him. B asked him whether he would be at S's concert. My father answered indifferently that he did not know, that he had business of more importance than any concerts and any foreign celebrities, but, however, he would wait and see, and if he had an hour free, he might perhaps go in. Then he looked rapidly at B and Prince X, and smiled mistrustfully, then snatched at his hat, nodded, and walked by, saying he was in a hurry. But even the day before, I was aware of my father's anxiety. I did not know exactly what it was that was worrying him, but I saw that he was terribly uneasy. Even Mother noticed it. She was extremely ill at the time, and could scarcely put one foot before the other. Father was continually coming in and going out. In the morning, 3 or 4 visitors, old companions in the orchestra, came to see him, at which I was greatly surprised,
as, except Karl Fyodorich, we scarcely ever saw anyone, and all our acquaintances had dropped us since father had quite given up the theatre. At last Karl Fyodorich ran in, panting, and brought a poster. I listened and watched attentively, and all this troubled me as much as though I alone were responsible for all this commotion and for the uneasiness I read on my father's face. I longed to understand what they were talking about, and for the first time I heard the name of S. Then I grasped that the sum of 15 rubles at least was necessary in order to see this S. I remember, too, that father could not refrain from saying with a wave of his hand that he knew these foreign prodigies, these unique geniuses. He knew S, too, that they were all Jews running after Russian money, because the Russians in their simplicity would believe in any nonsense, and especially anything the French made a fuss about. I knew already what was meant by the words, not a genius. The visitors began laughing, and soon all of them went away, leaving father thoroughly out of humour. I realised that he was angry with S for some reason, and to propitiate him and to distract his attention, I went up to the table, took up the poster, began spelling it out, and read aloud the name of S. Then, laughing and looking towards father, who was sitting on a chair brooding, said, "I expect he is another one like Karl Fyodorich. I expect he won't hit it off either." Father stared as though he were frightened, tore the poster out of my hands, shouted at me, stamped, and snatching up his hat was about to go out of the room, but came back at once, called me out into the passage, kissed me, and with uneasiness, with some secret dread, began saying to me that I was a good, clever child, that he was sure I had not meant to wound him, that he was reckoning on me to do him a great service, but what it was exactly he did not say. Moreover, it was bitter to me to listen to him. I saw that his words and his endearments were not genuine, and all this had a shattering effect on me. Next day at dinner, it was the day before the concert, father seemed utterly crushed. He was completely changed, and was incessantly looking at mother. At last, to my surprise, he actually began talking to mother. I was surprised because he hardly ever said anything to her. After dinner, he began being particularly attentive to me. He was continually, on various pretexts, calling me into the passage, and, looking about him as though he were frightened of being caught, he kept patting me on the head, kissing me and telling me that I was a good child, that I was an obedient child, that he was sure I loved Daddy and would do what he was going to ask me. All this made me unbearably miserable. At last, when for the 10th time he called me out into the passage, the mystery was explained. With a miserable, harassed face, looking away uneasily, he asked me whether I knew where mother had put the 25 rubles she had brought in the morning before. I was ready to die with terror when I heard this question. But at that moment, someone made a noise on the stairs, and father, alarmed, abandoned me and ran out. It was evening when he came back, confused, sad, and careworn. He sat down in silence and began looking at me with something like joy in his face. A feeling of dread came over me, and I avoided his eyes. At last, mother, who had been in bed all day, called me, gave me some coppers, and sent me to the shop to buy tea and sugar. We rarely drank tea. Mother permitted herself this luxury, as it was for our means, only when she felt ill and feverish. I took the money, and as soon as I got into the passage, set off to run as though I were afraid of being overtaken. But what I had foreseen happened. Father overtook me in the street and turned me back to the stairs.
"Netochka," he said in a shaking voice, "my darling, listen, give me that money, and tomorrow I'll—"
"Daddy! Daddy!"
I cried, falling on my knees and imploring him.
"Daddy! I can't! I mustn't! Mother needs the tea. I mustn't take it from mother. I mustn't. I'll get it another time."
"So you won't? You won't?"
he whispered in a sort of frenzy.
"So you won't love me?
Oh, very well. I shall have nothing more to do with you, then. You can stay with Mother, and I shall go away and shan't take you with me. Do you hear, you wicked girl? Do you hear?
Daddy! I cried, filled with horror. Take the money! What can I do now?
I cried, wringing my hands and clutching at the skirts of his coat.
Mother will cry! Mother will scold me again!
Apparently he had not expected so much resistance, yet he took the money. At last, unable to endure my sobs and lamentations, he left me on the stairs and ran down. I went upstairs, but my strength failed me at the door of our garret. I did not dare to go in. Every feeling in me was revolted and shattered. I hid my face in my hands and ran to the window, as I had done when first I heard my father say he wished for my mother's death. I was in a sort of stupor, in a state of numbness, and kept starting as I listened to every sound on the stairs. At last I heard someone coming rapidly upstairs. It was he. I recognized his step.
"You are here?"
he said in a whisper. I flew to him.
"There,"
he said, thrusting the money into my hand.
"There! Take it back! I am not your father now, do you hear? I don't care to be your father. You love Mother more than me. So go to Mother. But I don't want to have anything to do with you."
As he said this, he pushed me away and ran downstairs again. Weeping, I flew to overtake him.
"Daddy! Dear Daddy! I will be obedient,"
I cried.
"I love you more than Mother. Take the money back. Take it."
But he did not hear me. He had vanished. All that evening I felt more dead than alive, and shivered as though in a fever. I remember Mother said something to me, called me to her. I was hardly conscious. I could hear and see nothing. It ended in violent hysterics. I began crying and screaming. Mother was frightened and did not know what to do. She took me into her bed, and I don't remember how I fell asleep, with my arms round her neck, trembling and starting with fright at every instant. The whole night passed like that. In the morning I woke up very late. Mother was no longer in the room. At that time she went out every day to her work. There was someone with Father, and they were both talking in loud voices. I had to wait till the visitor was gone, and when we were left alone I flew to my father and begged him, sobbing, to forgive me for what had happened the day before.
"But will you be a good girl as you were before?"
he asked me grimly.
"Yes, Daddy, yes," I answered. "I will tell you where Mother's money is put. It was lying yesterday in a box in the little chest."
"It was? Where?"
he cried, starting, and got up from his chair.
"Where was it?"
"It's locked up, Father," I said. "Wait a little. In the evening, when Mother goes to get change, for there are not coppers left, I saw."
"I must have 15 rubles, Nyatochka. Do you hear? Only 15 rubles. Get it me today. I will bring it all back to you tomorrow, and I will go directly and buy you some sugar candy. I will buy you some nuts. I will buy you a doll, too. And tomorrow, again, and I will bring you little treats every day if you will be a good girl."
"You needn't, Daddy, you needn't. I don't want treats. I won't eat them. I shall give them you back,"
I cried, choking with tears all of a sudden, for my heart seemed bursting. I felt at that moment that he had no pity for me, and that he did not love me because he saw how I loved him, but thought that I was ready to serve him for the sake of treats. At that moment I, a child, understood him through and through, and felt that that understanding had wounded me for ever, that I could not love him as before, that I had lost the old Daddy. He was in a kind of ecstasy over my promise. He saw that I was ready to do anything for him, that I had done everything for him, and God knows how much that everything was to me then. I knew what that money meant to my poor mother. I knew that she might be ill with distress at losing it, and remorse was crying aloud in me and rending my heart. But he saw nothing. He thought of me as though I were a child of three, while I understood it all. His delight knew no bounds. He kissed me, tried to coax me not to cry, promised that that very day he would leave Mother and go off somewhere, meaning, I suppose, to flatter the daydream that never left me. He took a poster out of his pocket, began assuring me that the man he was going to see today was his enemy, his mortal enemy, but that his enemies would not succeed. He was exactly like a child himself, as he talked to me about his enemies. Noticing that I was not smiling as usual when he talked to me, and was listening to him in silence, he took up his hat and went out of the room, for he was in a hurry to go off somewhere. But as he went out, he kissed me again and nodded to me with a smile, as though he were not quite sure of me, and, as it were, trying to prevent my changing my mind. I have said already that he was like a madman, but that had been apparent the day before. He needed the money to get a ticket for the concert which was to decide everything for him. He seemed to feel beforehand that this concert was to decide his fate, but he was so beside himself that the day before he had tried to take those few coppers from me as though he could get a ticket with them. His strange condition showed itself even more distinctly at dinner. He simply could not sit still and did not touch a morsel. He was continually getting up from his seat and sitting down again, as though he were hesitating. At one moment he would snatch up his hat as though he were going off somewhere, then suddenly he became strangely absent-minded, kept whispering something to himself, then suddenly glanced at me, winked, made some sign to me as though impatient to get the money as soon as possible, and was angry with me for not having obtained it yet. My mother even noticed his strange behaviour, and looked at him in surprise. I felt as though I were under sentence of death. Dinner was over. I huddled in a corner and, shivering as though I were in a fever, counted the minutes to the hour when Mother usually sent me to the shop. I have never spent more agonizing hours in my life. They will live in my memory for ever. What feelings did I not pass through in my imagination? There are moments in which you go through more in your inner consciousness than in whole years of actual life. I felt that I was doing something wicked. He had himself helped my good instincts when, like a coward, he had thrust me into evil doing the first time, and frightened by it had explained to me that I had done very wrong. How could he fail to see how hard it is to deceive an impressionable nature that had already felt and interpreted much good and evil? I understood, of course, what the horrible extremity was that drove him once more to thrust me into vice, to sacrifice my poor, defenceless childhood, and risk upsetting my unstable conscience again. And now, huddled in my corner, I wondered to myself why he had promised me rewards for what I had made up my mind to do of my own accord. New sensations, new impulses, unknown till then, new questions rose up crowding upon my mind, and I was tortured by these questions. Then all at once I began thinking about Mother. I pictured her distress at the loss of her last earnings. At last Mother laid down the work which she was doing with an effort and called me. I trembled and went to her. She took some money out of the chest of drawers, and as she gave it me, she said, "Run along, Nyetochka. Only God forbid that they should give you short change as they did the other day. And don't lose it, whatever happens." I looked with an imploring face at my father, but he nodded and smiled at me approvingly and rubbed his hands with impatience. The clock struck six, and the concert was at seven. He had had much to suffer in those hours of suspense, too. I stopped on the stairs, waiting for him. He was so excited and agitated that without any precaution he ran after me at once. I gave him the money. It was dark on the stairs and I could not see his face, but I felt that he was trembling all over as he took the money. I stood as though turned to stone, and did not move from the spot. I only came to myself when he sent me upstairs again to fetch his hat.
"Daddy, surely aren't you coming with me?"
I asked in a breaking voice, thinking of my last hope, his protection.
"No, you had better go alone, eh? Wait a minute, wait a minute!"
he cried, catching himself up. "Wait a minute. I will get you something nice directly. Only you go in first and bring my hat here." I felt as though an icy hand had been laid upon my heart. I shrieked, pushed him away, and rushed upstairs. When I went into the room, my face was full of horror, and if I had tried to say that I had been robbed of the money, Mother would have believed me. But I could say nothing at that moment. In a paroxysm of convulsive despair, I threw myself across my mother's bed and hid my face in my hands. A minute later, the door creaked timidly, and Father came in. He had come for his hat. "Where is the money?" cried my mother, suddenly guessing that something extraordinary had happened. "Where is the money? Speak! Speak!" Then she snatched me up from the bed and stood me in the middle of the room. I stood mute with my eyes on the floor. I scarcely understood what was happening to me and what they were doing to me. "Where is the money?" she cried again, leaving me and suddenly turning on Father, who had caught up his hat. "Where is the money?" she repeated. "Ah, she has given it to you, godless wretch. You have murdered me. You have destroyed me. So you will ruin her too? A child? Her? No, you shall not go off like that." And in one instance she had flown to the door, locked it on the inside, and taken the key. "Speak. Confess," she said to me in a voice scarcely audible from emotion. "Tell me all about it. Speak, speak, or I don't know what I shall do to you." She seized my hands and wrung them as she questioned me. At that instant, I vowed to be silent and not say a word about Father, but timidly raised my eyes to him for the last time. One look, one word from him, such as I was expecting and praying for in my heart, and I should have been happy in spite of any agony, any torture. But, my God! With a callous, threatening gesture, he commanded me to be silent, as though I could be afraid of any other threat at that moment. There was a lump in my throat, my breath failed me, my legs gave way under me, and I fell senseless on the floor. I had a second nervous attack, like the one the day before. I came to myself when there was a sudden knock at the door of our garret. Mother unlocked the door and saw a man in livery who, coming into the room and looking round in amazement at all three of us, asked for the musician Yefimov. My stepfather introduced himself. Then the footman gave him a note and announced that he came from B, who was at that moment at Prince X's. In the envelope lay an invitation ticket to S's concert. The arrival of a footman in gorgeous livery, who mentioned the name of Prince X as his master, who had sent on purpose to fetch Yefimov, a poor musician. All this instantly made a great impression on my mother. I have mentioned already when describing her character that the poor woman still loved my father, and now, in spite of 8 years of perpetual misery and suffering, her heart was still unchanged. She still could love him. God knows. Perhaps at this moment she imagined a complete change in his fortunes. Even the faintest shadow of hope had an influence on her. How can one tell? Perhaps she, too, was a little infected by her crazy husband's unshakable self-confidence. And indeed, it would have been impossible that his self-confidence should not have had some influence on a weak woman. And on Prince X's attention, she might instantly build 1,000 plans for him. In an instant, she was ready to turn to him again. She was ready to forgive him for all her life, even to overlook his last crime, the sacrifice of her only child, and in a rush of renewed enthusiasm, in a rush of new hope, to reduce that crime to an ordinary act, an act of cowardice to which he had been driven by poverty, his degraded life, and his desperate position. Everything with her was impulsive, and in an instant she had forgiveness and boundless compassion for her ruined husband. My father began bustling about. He, too, was impressed by this attention from Prince X and B. He turned straight away to Mother, whispered something to her, and she went out of the room. She came back 2 minutes later, having changed the money, and Father immediately gave a silver ruble to the messenger, who went away with a polite bow. Meanwhile, Mother, after going out for a minute, brought an iron, got out her husband's best shirt front, and began ironing it. She herself tied round his neck a white cambric cravat, which had been preserved from time immemorial in his wardrobe, together with his black, by now very shabby, dress coat, which had been made for him when he was in the orchestra of a theatre. When his toilet was complete, Father took his hat, but as he was going out, asked for a glass of water. He was pale, and sat down on a chair for a minute, feeling faint. I had recovered sufficiently to hand him the water. Perhaps the feeling of hostility had stolen back again into Mother's heart and cooled her first enthusiasm. Father went away. We were left alone. I crouched in the corner and for a long time watched my mother in silence. I had never before seen her in such excitement. Her lips were quivering, her pale cheeks suddenly glowed, and from time to time she trembled all over. At last her misery began to find an outlet in complaining, in stifled sobs and lamentation.
"It is all my fault, wretched mother that I am," she said, talking to herself. "What will become of her? What will become of her when I die?"
She went on, standing still in the middle of the room, as though thunderstruck by the very thought.
"Nietochka! My child! My poor little child! Oh, unhappy child!"
she said, taking me by the hand and embracing me convulsively.
"How will you be left after I am dead? When even now I can't educate you, look after you and watch over you as I ought. Ah, oh, you don't understand me. Do you understand? Will you remember what I have just said to you, Nietochka? Will you remember it in the future?" "I will, Mother, I will," I said, clasping my hands and beseeching her.
She held me tight in a long embrace, as though trembling at the very thought of parting from me. My heart was bursting.
"Mummy! Mummy!"
I said, sobbing.
"Why is it? Why is it you don't love Daddy?"
And my sobs prevented my finishing. A groan broke from her bosom. Then, in a new rush of terrible misery, she began walking up and down the room.
"My poor, poor child! And I did not notice how she was growing up. She knows all about it. My God! What an impression! What an example!"
And again she wrung her hands in despair. Then she came up to me, and with frenzied love kissed me, kissed my hands, bathed them with tears, sought my forgiveness. I have never seen such suffering. At last she seemed exhausted and fell into apathy. So passed a whole hour. Then she got up, weary and exhausted, and told me to go to bed. I went off into my corner, wrapped myself up in the quilt, but could not get to sleep. I was worried about her, and I was worried about Father. I waited his return with impatience. I was possessed by a kind of terror at the thought of him. Half an hour later, Mother took a candle and came up to me to see whether I was asleep. To soothe her, I shut my eyes tight and pretended to be asleep. After looking at me, she went very quietly to the cupboard, opened it, and poured herself out a glass of wine. She drank it and went to sleep, leaving a candle alight on the table and the door unlocked, as she always did when Father might come in late. I lay in a sort of stupor, but sleep would not come to me. As soon as I had closed my eyes, I woke up again trembling at some horrible vision. My misery grew more acute every minute. I wanted to cry out, but the scream died away in my breast. At last, late in the night, I heard our door open. I don't remember how long it was afterwards, but when I opened my eyes, I saw Father. It seemed to me that he was fearfully pale. He was sitting in a chair close to the door and seemed to be lost in thought. There was a deathly stillness in the room. The guttering candle shed a mournful light over our abode. I watched him a long time, but still Father did not move from his seat. He was sitting motionless, still in the same position, with his head bowed and his hands pressed rigidly against his knees. Several times I attempted to call to him, but could not. My state of numb stupor persisted. At last he suddenly came to himself, raised his head and got up from his chair. He stood for some minutes in the middle of the room as though he were making some decision, then suddenly went up to my mother's bed, listened, and assuring himself that she was asleep, went to the chest where he kept his violin. He unlocked the chest, brought out the black violin case and put it on the table, then looked about him again. His eyes had a lusterless and wandering look, such as I had never seen in them before. He was about to take up the violin, but at once, leaving it, went back and shut the door. Then, noticing the open cupboard, went stealthily to it, saw the glass and the wine, poured some out and drank it. Then, for the third time, he took up the violin, but for the third time put it down and went up to Mother's bed. Rigid with terror, I watched to see what would happen. He listened for a very long time, then put the quilt over her face and began feeling her with his hand. I started. He bent down once more and almost put his head to her, but when he got up the last time there seemed a gleam of a smile on his fearfully white face. He quietly and carefully covered the sleeping figure with the quilt, covered her head, her feet, and I began trembling with a terror I did not understand. I felt frightened for Mother. I felt terrified by her deep sleep, and I looked with uneasiness at the immovable, angular fine of her limbs under the quilt. Like lightning, the fearful thought flashed through me. When he had finished all these preliminaries, he went back to the cupboard again and drank off the rest of the wine. He was trembling all over as he went to the table. His face was unrecognizable, it was so white. Then he took up the violin again. I saw the violin and knew what it was, but now I expected something awful, terrible, monstrous. I shuddered at the first note. Father began playing, but the notes came, as it were, jerkily. He kept stopping as though he were recalling something. At last, with a harassed, agonized face, put down his bow and looked strangely at the bed. Something there still troubled him. He went up to the bed again. I did not miss a single movement he made, and almost swooning with a feeling of horror, watched him. All at once he began hurriedly groping for something, and again the same fearful thought flashed through me like lightning. I wondered why Mother slept so soundly. How was it she did not wake when he touched her face with his hand? At last I saw him getting together all the clothes he could. He took Mother's pelisse, his old frock coat, his dressing gown, even the clothes that I had thrown off when I went to bed, so that he covered Mother completely and hid her under the pile thrown on her. She still lay motionless, not stirring a limb. She was sleeping soundly. He seemed to breathe more freely when he had finished his task. This time nothing hindered him, but yet he was still uneasy. He moved the candle and stood with his face towards the door, so as not even to look towards the bed. At last he took the violin, and with a despairing gesture drew his bow across it. The music began. But it was not music. I remember everything distinctly. To the last moment I remembered everything that caught my attention at the time. No, this was not music such as I have heard since. They were not the notes of the violin, but some terrible voice seemed to be resounding for the first time in our room. Either my impressions were abnormal and due to delirium, or my senses had been so affected by all I had witnessed and were prepared for terrible and agonizing impressions, but I am firmly convinced that I heard groans. the cry of a human voice, weeping. Utter despair flowed forth in these sounds, and at the end, when there resounded the last awful chord which seemed to combine all the horror of lamentation, the very essence of torment, of hopeless despair, I could not bear it. I began trembling. Tears spurted from my eyes, and rushing at father with a fearful, despairing shriek, I clutched at his hands. He uttered a cry and dropped the violin. He stood for a minute as though bewildered. At last his eyes began darting and straying from side to side. He seemed to be looking for something. Suddenly he snatched up the violin, brandished it above me, and another minute and he would perhaps have killed me on the spot.
"Daddy!"
I shouted at him.
"Daddy!"
He trembled like a leaf when he heard my voice, and stepped back a couple of paces.
"Oh, so you are still left? So it's not all over yet? So you are still left with me?"
he shouted, lifting me in the air above his shoulders.
"Daddy!" I cried again. "For God's sake, don't terrify me! I am frightened! Oh!"
My wail impressed him. He put me down on the ground gently and for a minute looked at me without speaking, as though recognizing and remembering something. At last, as though at some sudden revulsion, as though at some awful thought, tears gushed from his lusterless eyes. He bent down and began looking intently in my face.
"Daddy!" I said to him, racked by terror. "Don't look like that! Let us go away from here! Let us make haste and go away! Let us go! Let us run away!"
"Yes, we'll run away. We'll run away. It's high time. Come along, Nyetochka. Make haste, make haste!"
And he rushed about as though he had only now grasped what he must do. He looked hurriedly around, and seeing Mother's handkerchief on the ground, picked it up and put it in his pocket. Then he saw her cap, and picked that up too and put it in his pocket, as though preparing for a long journey and putting together everything he would want. I got my clothes on in an instant, and in haste I too began snatching up everything which I fancied necessary for the journey.
"Is everything ready? Everything?" asked my father. "Is everything ready? Make haste! Make haste!"
I hurriedly tied up my bundle, threw a kerchief on my head, and we were about to set off when the idea occurred to me that I must take the picture which was hanging on the wall. Father instantly agreed to this. Now he was quiet, spoke in a whisper, and only urged me to make haste and start. The picture hung very high up. Together we brought a chair, put a stool on it, and clambering on it, after prolonged efforts, took it down. Then everything was ready for our journey. He took me by the hand, and we had almost started when Father suddenly stopped me. He rubbed his forehead for some minutes, as though trying to remember something which had not been done. At last, he seemed to find what he wanted. He felt for the key which lay under Mother's pillow and began hurriedly looking for something in the chest of drawers. At last he came back to me and brought me some money he had found in the box.
"Here, take this. Take care of it,"
he whispered to me.
"Don't lose it. Remember, remember!"
At first he put the money in my hand, then took it back and thrust it in the bosom of my dress. I remembered that I shuddered when that silver touched my body, and it seemed that only then I understood what money meant. Now we were ready again. But all at once he stopped me again.
"Nyetochka,"
he said to me as though reflecting with an effort.
"My child, I have forgotten... What is it? I can't remember. Yes, yes, I have found it. I remember. Come here, Nyetochka."
He led me to the corner where the holy image stood and told me to kneel down.
"Pray, my child, pray. You will feel better. Yes, really, it will be better,"
he whispered, pointing to the icon and looking at me strangely.
"Say your prayers,"
he said, in an imploring voice. I dropped on my knees, and clasping my hands, full of horror and despair, which by now had gained complete possession of me, I sank on the floor and lay there for some moments without breathing. I strained every thought, every feeling to pray, but tears overwhelmed me. I got up exhausted with misery. I no longer wanted to go with him. I was frightened of him. At last, what harassed and tortured me burst out.
"Daddy!"
I said, melting into tears.
"And Mummy! What's the matter with Mummy? Where is she? Where's my Mummy?"
I could not go on. I wept bitterly. He shed tears too as he looked at me. At last he took me by the hand, led me up to the bed, swept away the pile of clothes, and turned down the quilt. My God! She lay dead, already cold and blue. Almost senseless, I flung myself on her and threw my arms round her dead body. My father made me kneel down.
"Bow down to her, child," he said. "Say goodbye to her."
I bowed down. My father bowed down beside me. He was fearfully pale. His lips were trembling and whispering something.
"It wasn't I, Nyatochka, it wasn't I,"
he said, pointing at the dead body with a trembling finger.
"Do you hear? It was not I. It was not my doing. Remember, Nyatochka."
"Daddy, let us go,"
I whispered in terror.
"It's time."
"Yes, it is time now. We ought to have gone long ago,"
he said, gripping me tightly by the hand, in haste to get out of the room.
"Now let us set off. Thank God, thank God, now it is all over."
We went down the stairs. The drowsy porter unlocked the gate for us, looking at us suspiciously. And father, as though afraid he would question him, ran out of the gate first, so that I had difficulty in overtaking him. We went down our street and came out on the bank of the canal. Snow had fallen on the pavement overnight and was coming down in tiny flakes now. It was cold. I was chilled to the bone, and ran along with father, clutching convulsively at the skirts of his coat. His violin was under his arm, and he was continually stopping to prevent it slipping. We walked for a quarter of an hour. At last he turned along the sloping pavement down to the edge of the canal and sat down on the farthest part. There was a hole cut in the ice 2 paces from us. There was not a sound around. Oh, God! How I remember to this day the terrible feeling that overpowered me. At last everything of which I had been dreaming for a whole year had come to pass. We had left our poor home. But was this what I was expecting? Was it of this I was dreaming? Was this the creation of my childhood imagination, when I looked into the future for the happiness of him whom I loved with a passion so unlike a child's? Above all, the thought of mother tortured me at that moment. Why had we left her alone? I wondered. We had abandoned her body like some useless thing. I remember that that harassed and tortured me more than anything. "Daddy!" I began, unable to endure my agonizing thoughts.
"Daddy!"
"What is it?" he said sullenly.
"Why have we left Mummy there, Daddy? Why have we deserted her?"
I asked, beginning to cry.
"Daddy, let us go home again. Let us fetch someone to her."
"Yes, yes,"
he said, starting and getting up from the post, as though some new idea had come into his mind which settled all his doubts.
"Yes, Nyatochka, it won't do. We must go to Mother. She is cold there. You go to her, Nyatochka. It isn't dark. There's a candle there. Don't be frightened. Fetch someone to her, and then come back to me. You go alone, and I will wait for you here. I won't go away."
I went at once, but I had scarcely reached the pavement when something seemed to stab me to the heart. I turned round and saw that he was already running in the opposite direction and was running away from me, leaving me alone, abandoning me at such a moment. I screamed as loud as I could and, panic-stricken, flew to overtake him. I gasped for breath. He ran faster and faster. I lost sight of him. On the way, I came upon his hat, which he had lost in his flight. I picked it up and fell to running again. My breath failed me, and my legs gave way under me. I felt as though something hideous were happening to me. It kept seeming to me that it was a dream, and at times I had the sensation I had had in dreams, that I was running away from someone, but that my legs were giving way under me, that I was being overtaken and was falling senseless. An agonizing sensation was rending my heart. I was sorry for him. My heart ached when I realized that he was running without an overcoat, without a hat, away from me, away from his beloved child. I wanted to overtake him, simply to kiss him warmly once more, to tell him not to be afraid of me, to soothe him, to assure him that I would not run after him if he did not wish it, but would go back alone to Mother. I made out at last that he had turned down a street. Running to it and turning down it, I could still discern him before me. Then my strength failed me. I began crying and screaming. I remember that as I ran, I knocked up against two passers-by who stopped in the middle of the pavement and looked after us in amazement. "Daddy! Daddy!" I cried for the last time, but I slipped on the pavement and fell at the gateway of a house. I felt my whole face bathed in blood. A moment later, I lost consciousness. I came to myself in a soft, warm bed and saw beside me kind, welcoming faces which greeted my recovery with delight. I made out an old woman with spectacles on her nose, a tall gentleman who looked at me with deep compassion, then a lovely young lady, and last of all a grey-headed old man who held my hand and looked at his watch. I woke up to a new life. One of the people I had rushed up against in my flight was Prince X, and I had fallen down at the gate of his house. When, after long investigations, it was found out who I was, the prince who had sent my father the ticket for S's concert, impressed by the strangeness of the coincidence, resolved to take me into his house and bring me up with his own children. Search was made to discover what had become of my father, and it was ascertained that he had been apprehended outside the town, suffering from an attack of acute mania. He was taken to the hospital, where he died 2 days later. He died because such a death was a necessity to him, the natural consequence of such a life. He was bound to die like that, when everything that had supported him in life crumbled away at once and faded away like a phantom, like an insubstantial empty dream. He died when his last hope vanished, when in one instant everything with which he had deceived himself and sustained himself through life fell to pieces before his eyes. The truth blinded him with its unbearable light, and what was false was recognized as false by himself. At his last hour he had heard a marvelous genius who had revealed to him himself and condemned him forever. With the last sound that floated from the strings of the master's violin, the whole mystery of art was revealed to him, and genius, ever youthful, powerful, and true, had crushed him by its truth. It seemed as though all that had weighed upon him his whole life in mysterious, unfathomable agonies, all that had hitherto tortured him impalpably, elusively, only in dreams, that had taken clear shape at times, though he had run from it in horror, screening himself with a lie all his life, all of which he had had a presentiment, though he had feared to face it, all this had suddenly flashed upon him at once, had been laid bare to his eyes, which had till then stubbornly refused to recognize light for light, darkness for darkness. But the truth was more than his eyes could endure when he gazed upon what had been, what was, and what awaited him. It blinded and burnt up his reason. It had struck him down at once, inexorably like lightning. what he had been expecting all his life with a tremor and a sinking of his heart, had suddenly happened. It seemed as though an axe had been hanging over his head all his life. All his life he had been every moment expecting in unutterable anguish that it would strike him, and at last the axe had struck him. The blow was fatal. He tried to flee from the sentence passed upon him, but there was nowhere for him to flee. His last hope had vanished, his last excuse had disappeared. The woman whose life had weighed upon him so many years, who would not let him live, at whose death, as he blindly believed, he would suddenly revive again, died. At last he was alone. There was nothing to hamper him. At last he was free. For the last time, in convulsive despair, he tried to judge himself, to judge himself sternly and relentlessly, like a partial, disinterested critic. But his enfeebled bow could only faintly repeat the last musical phrase of the genius. At that instant, madness, which had been stalking him for 10 years, clutched him beyond escape.